This is the Seattle Public Library podcast of the Jack Straw Writers Program 10th Anniversary Celebration. Writers from the program's last decade read their work at the Central Library June 25th, 2006.
Hi, I'm Barty Kirshner. I was a Jack Straw Fellow in the years 1999 and 2005. I'm going to read a little bit from my latest novel, Pastries. It's a novel, not a cookbook, and it's in paperback now. I'm going to read just a couple of passages from the first chapter. I, Sunia Malhotra, am a woman who lives to bake. This morning, I spring out of bed at 5 a.m., just as the sparrows are beginning to twitter, and soon drive, bleary-eyed, the 10 blocks to my bakery. Once in the airy kitchen, I go straight to the counter, caress its marble surface, and revel in the joy of its clean, cool touch. Before long, I'm sifting the pastry flour into a mixing bowl with a rhythmic motion. I can't resist occasionally dipping my fingers into the sensuous powder. A glance at the wall clock tells me it's time to stop dawdling and get cracking. Egg yolks slide into one bowl and whites into another. The yolks shimmer like a pool of captured sunlight. Whites repose, a limpid mass that magnifies the mosaic pattern on the bottom of the copper bowls. Finally, I set the pieces of premium chocolate in a water bath over a low flame, where they melt into a dark liquid with bittersweet perfume. Whipping egg whites became a ritual for me a long time ago, and I begin to make quick strokes with a hand whisk. In the background, the notes of a Baroque melody float from the radio. Roger, the recently departed love of my life, drifts into my mind. He adored that Baroque piece. These solitary morning hours are still the hardest, but I'm passionate to work, to bake my signature creation, the Sunia cake. In only a few hours, a newspaper food critic will interview me about my best-selling item. Just the thought puts me on edge. I am the sole proprietor of Pastries Cafe, a trendy 20-seat bakery in Seattle. Lately in food circles, my Sunia cake has created quite a stir, thanks to sensational reviews and word of mouth. This success is all the more surprising because the cafe is tucked away in the quiet residential district of Wallingford, 5 miles from the glitter of downtown and its boutiques, night spots, museums, and restaurants. A scorching smell fouls the air. I whirl around and find my pricey chocolate charred. How could I have been so careless? Every pastry chef learns that the temperamental chocolate, highly sensitive to fluctuations of both heat and humidity, is the toughest ingredient to handle. Until this minute, I believed I had mastered it. I find this lapse in my baker's instinct terrifying, especially now with a deadline hanging over me. By 8:30, the cakes must be ready to fill advance orders. Hurriedly, I scrape the scorched paste into the sink and switch on the fan. Then I glance at the old familiar standbys on the counter. Pastry flour, eggs, sugar, leavenings, chocolate, vanilla, and my secret ingredients. The flour has been freshly ground from soft winter wheat. The sexy Venezuelan chocolate obtained from a renowned vendor in Salt Lake City. The plump, fragrant vanilla beans flown in from Papantla in Mexico. I use only the highest quality raw materials to ensure the best possible product. I stand over the second batch of chocolate mixture, breathing the buttery mist until the correct temperature, the glossy stage is reached. At last, I swirl the dry ingredients into the moist ones, working more quickly than usual. Particles of flour rising around me. I divide the batter into several cake pans, slide them into the oven, and close the door with a bang. With a free moment on hand, I pondered the alchemy taking place inside the oven, how the high temperature is fusing a few choice ingredients into a triumphant confection. Rich, delicious, unforgettable, and uniquely Sunia. Thank you.
My name is Barbara Earl Thomas, and I want to thank Jack Straw Writers series and also Nancy Rawls. I was from 2001. This piece is called Mannequins. I pushed with all my 9-year-old weight out the door of the heavily chromed 1958 Oldsmobile and jumped down into the concrete. I waved off my father and made my way into Lerner's Dress Shop, past the Women's Foundation, down the staircase, through the children's section to the very back of the store. There my mother worked in two windowless rooms with exposed pipes that hissed and kept the place hot and sweaty. One was filled with ironing boards, flat irons, boxes of out-of-season clothes, and a variety of stage props she used to create her window scenes. The other, a staging area, contained a gaggle of arms, legs, heads, and tumbled torsos strewn about, disassembled bodies that lay in wait for their turn to be prepped and placed in the display window dramas. Mom was there, clad in her Barbara Stanwyck-tailored work jacket, Kleenex tucked inside her sleeve, and the red pin cushion bracelet that gripped her wrist just above her perfectly tapered fingers. Without raising her head, she lifted an eyebrow and acknowledged me. Her agile fingers moved in flutters as she ironed, pinned, and taped the trouser legs around the mannequin's legs to give them appearance of motion or to reveal some accessory. The lucky mannequins would end up in the island window, also known as the hot box, because of all the spotlights. I liked the island window best. It was a waterless aquarium. I could walk all around and see a world filled with plaster people, paper trees, and plastic lawns. Between displays, she covered the windows to prevent peeks at uncovered breasts or legless torsos. She concealed their private parts, even though there wasn't really anything to see. They were all smooth down there, just like my dolls. I knew it because I'd seen and felt them all. In the staging area, half bodies stood supported by metal rods that went straight up their butts. I wandered between legs, ran my hands over breasts, and across the cool beige stucco of their plaster skin. From the permanent goosebumps on their never warm bodies, I found a curious excitement. My own breasts were small and filled lately with lumpy, tender center that floated in a gelatinous fluid underneath my swollen skin. The lumpy matter moved freely as I pushed it, which I only did late at night and gently because it hurt. When I pointed this out to my mother, right away she got the doctor on the phone and in a quavery voice, all the time fingering my breast like she was blind, described to him the lumps and the swelling. Halfway through, her face went slack. What, she said? Really? Really? It's not cancer? She whispered. She looked like a tourist who had just learned she was in the wrong city. When she hung up, she said, "It's all right. It's all right." How had I come to become the subject of all of this? "It's your breasts. They're growing," she stammered. "Growing into what?" I asked. "Breasts. Just breasts." With that, she stood and left the room. Later, I'd catch her watching me like a wary cat, sit up and stop flopping around. And apropos to nothing, she added, "I don't want to ever catch you sitting on anybody's lap, especially men, not even your father." Then, as if she were talking to herself from some space between what was and is, she said, "You gotta be careful in this world. Pay attention. Keep your legs shut. Things happen." That's all she said. Things happen. There in the dark staging area were my favorite mannequins, one I called Boney and the other one I called Lorraine, after my mother's two best friends. The child mannequins were of no interest to me. I liked Boney and Lorraine. Next to them, I stood waist high. I slipped my arms in around their waist, raised an eyelid, and called them by their first names. I liked to talk to them in whispers and coded language, admonished them in my mother's voice. "Girl, you need to quit all that. If you let them fools drive you crazy, ain't nobody's business, ain't nobody's fault but your own." Out of my mother's sight, I mounted a stool, edged up, sidled close, pushed my flesh onto their unyielding contours, tried to imagine their scents beyond cold plaster. Maybe it was gardenia on moist skin or smoky breath slipping over red waxed lips. I gathered them in my arms, pressed my mouth into their hard surface of their eternally pastel lips, and kissed them just like I'd seen in the movies. From one to the other I went, again and again, with quickened breath, willing life into their unbreathing mouths. Light-headed, light-headed. Maybe it was when the stool flipped, sending plaster over flesh, tumbling into dark darkness and soft carnage, or when I heard my mother gasp and I knew instinctively she was running toward me, that I realized I'd never imagined her or my father locked in any other unnamed want and that I'd never seen them kiss. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Laura Gamache. I was a Jack Straw writer in 99 and then in 2002. I'm going to read my first poem. It's called After the Primate House Demolition, and it's dedicated to Bobo, who was the gorilla who lived in the primate house at the Woodland Park Zoo from 1953 to 1968. "We could see you anytime, hoisting yourself to the tire swing that hung from a phony tree or pacing green cement. You made faces, pounded your leather chest, unfurled hairy brown fingers with a tenderness that made me ashamed of the glass. When the older kids jeered at you, you hunched with your back to us. Everybody knew you'd lived in a house, worn human clothes and shoes, eaten human food. You were almost one of us. They bullied you. I thought we knew each other. How frightened we were. How lonely." This is called Last Tree in the Orchard. "Last tree in the orchard, and rain is coming. Heavy drops will drum, split cherries. You and four Mexicans climb ladders. Your fingers are cracked and black, bleed when you open your hand. Your bucket clipped to the canvas strap you wear like a bandolier. You've labored for weeks to match their speed. You're up to four bins a day. They pick 10. They don't pick leaves, and they don't pick green fruit. They joke and sing. They tell you stories like you're 3 years old and slow, as much Spanish as you understand. You watch their fingers to teach your own to pluck as you reach from your rickety rung. Thunder threatens from over the hill. Lightning lunges from the side of your eye. You're so young, you see a flock in the strobe of a new kind of bird. There is nothing to hold on to. Try it. A sprig of lavender, for instance. You hold it in your hand, breathe in. Next, you've set it on the dresser. Someone, your mate, the wind, spirits it away. You enfold your lover's finger in your palm. Then it's morning, sun everywhere, your empty fist pulsing. All this human design and destruction, millions of tons, thousands of souls, choking dust in the metropolis. What can you possibly hold on to? And this is a political meditation. It's entitled At Medgar Evers Pool. I don't know the answers, but I know how to breathe, to become indivisible with liberty of weightlessness, justice of lane lines. I take another breath into convoluted lungs. Each of us is coated in our own exhalation. In our man-made deep, we communicate through flip turns, the brush of a feathering hand. 36 laps out and back. What I have accomplished is clear. Thank you.